Side 2. It paid me, for I got my colours in the 11th with surprising speed. I put it down entirely to influence, for I was not to know then that over the past few months there had been a steady departure of officers from the regiment, sold out, transferred, and posted, and all because of Lord Cardigan, whom my uncle had spoken of. If I had been a little older, and moved in the right circles, I should have heard all about him. But in the few weeks of waiting for my commission, my father sent me up to Leicestershire. And the little time I had in town, I spent either by myself or in the company of such of my relatives as could catch me. My mother had had sisters, and although they disliked me heartily, they felt it was their duty to look after the poor motherless boy. So they said, in fact, they suspected that if I were left to myself, I would take to low company. And they were right. However, I was to find out about Lord Cardigan soon enough. In the last few days of buying my uniforms, assembling the huge paraphernalia that an officer needed in those days, far more than now, choosing a couple of horses and arranging for my allowance, I still found time on my hands, and Mistress Judy in my thoughts. My tumble with her had only whetted my appetite for more of her, I discovered. I tried to get rid of it with a farm girl in Leicestershire and a young whore in Covent Garden, but the one stank and the other picked my pocket afterwards, and neither was any substitute anyway. I wanted Judy at the same time as I felt spite for her, but she had avoided me since our quarrel, and if we met in the house, she simply ignored me. In the end, it got too much, and the night before I left, I went to her room again, having made sure the governor was out. She was reading, and looking damn desirable in a pale green negligee. I was a little drunk, and the sight of her white shoulders and red mouth sent the old tingle down my spine again. "What do you want?" she said, very icy. But I was expecting that, and had my speech ready. "I've come to beg pardon," I said, looking a bit hangdog. "Tomorrow I go away, and before I went I had to apologize for the way I spoke to you. I'm sorry, Judy, I truly am. I acted like a cad and a ruffian, and, well, I want to make what amends I can, that's all." She put down her book and turned on her stool to face me, still looking mighty cold, but saying nothing. I shuffled like a sheepish schoolboy. I could see my reflection in the mirror behind her and judge how the performance was going, and said again that I was sorry. "Very well, then," she said at last. "You're sorry. You have cause to be." I kept quiet, not looking at her. "Well, then," she said, after a pause, "good night." "Please, Judy," I said, looking distraught, "you make it very hard. If I behaved like a boor, you did. It was because I was angry and hurt and didn't understand why you wouldn't let me." I let it trail off and then burst out that I'd never known a woman like her before, and that I'd fallen in love with her and only came to ask her pardon because I couldn't bear the thought of her testing me, and a good deal more in the same strain. Simple enough rubbish, you may think, but I was still learning. At that, the mirror told me I was doing well. I finished by drawing myself up straight and looking solemn and saying, "And that is why I had to see you again, to tell you, and to ask your pardon." I gave her a little bow and turned to the door, rehearsing how I would stop and look back if she didn't stop me. But she took me at face value, for as I put my hand to the latch, she said, "Harry." I turned round, and she was smiling a little and looking sad. Then she smiled properly and shook her head and said, "Very well, Harry, if you want my pardon, for what it's worth, you have it. We'll say no—" "Judy!" I came striding back, smiling like souls awakening. "Oh, Judy, thank you!" And I held out my hand, frank and manly. She got up and took it, smiling still, but there was none of the old wanton glint about her eye. She was being stately and forgiving, like an aunt to a naughty nephew. The nephew, had she known it, was intent on incest. "Judy," I said, still holding her hand, "we're parting friends." "If you like," she said, trying to get it away. "Goodbye, Harry, and good luck." I stepped closer and kissed her hand, and she didn't seem to mind. I decided, like the fool I was, that the game was won. "Judy," I said again, "you're adorable. I love you, Judy. If only you knew, you're all I want in a woman. Oh, Judy, you're the most beautiful thing, all bum, belly, and bust. I love you." And I grabbed her to me, and she pulled free and got away from me. "No," she said, in a voice like steel. "Why the hell not?" I shouted. "Go away," she said, pale and with eyes like daggers. "Good night." "Good night be damned," says I. "I thought you said that we were parting friends. This ain't very friendly, is it?" She stood glaring at me. Her bosom was what the lady novelists call agitated, but if they had seen Judy agitated in a negligee, they would think of some other way of describing feminine distress. "I was a fool to listen to you for a moment," she says. "Leave this room at once." "All in good time," says I, and with a quick dart I caught her round the waist. She struck at me, but I ducked it, and we fell on the bed together. I had hold of the softness of her, and it maddened me. I caught her wrist as she struck at me again, like a tigress, and got my mouth on hers, and she bit me on the lip for all she was worth. I yelped and broke away, holding my mouth, and she, raging and panting, grabbed up some china dish and let fly at me. It missed by a long chalk, but it helped my temper over the edge completely. I lost control of myself altogether. "You bitch!" I shouted, and hit her across the face as hard as I could. She staggered, and I hit her again, and she went clean over the bed and onto the floor on the other side. I looked round for something to go after her with a cane or a whip, for I was in a frenzy and would have cut her to bits if I could. But there wasn't one handy, and by the time I'd got round to the bed to her, it had flashed across my mind that the house was full of servants, and my full reckoning with Miss Judy had better be postponed till another time. I stood over her, glaring and swearing, and she pulled herself up by a chair, holding her face. But she was game enough. "You coward," was all she would say. "You coward." "It's not cowardly to punish an insolent whore," says I. "Do you want some more?" She was crying, not sobbing, but with tears on her cheeks. She went over to her chair by the mirror, pretty unsteady, and sat down and looked at herself. I cursed her again, calling her the choicest names I could think of, but she worked at her cheek, which was red and bruised with a hare's foot, and paid no heed. She did not speak at all. "Well, be damned to you," says I at length. And with that I slammed out of the room. I was shaking with rage, and the pain in my lip, which was bleeding badly, reminded me that she had paid for my blows in advance. But she had got something in return, at all events. She would not forget Harry Flashman in a hurry. The 11th Light Dragoons at this time were newly back from India, where they had been serving since before I was born. They were a fighting regiment, and I say it without regimental pride, for I never had any, but, as a plain matter of fact, probably the finest mounted troops in England, if not in the world. Yet they had been losing officers since coming home hand over fist. The reason was James Brudenell, Earl of Cardigan. You've heard all about him, no doubt. The regimental scandals, the charge of the Light Brigade, the vanity, stupidity, and extravagance of the man, these things are history. Like most history, they have a fair basis of fact. But I knew him probably as few other officers knew him, and in turn I found him amusing, frightening, vindictive, charming, and downright dangerous. He was God's own original fool, there's no doubt of that. Although he was not to blame for the fiasco at Balaclava, that was Raglan and Airy between them. And he was arrogant as no other man I've ever met, and as sure of his own unshakable rightness as any man could be, even when his wrong-headedness was there for all to see. That was his great point, the key to his character. He could never be wrong. They say, at least, that he was brave. He was not. He was just stupid. Too stupid ever to be afraid. Fear is an emotion, and his emotions were all between his knees and his breastbone. They never touched his reason, and he had little enough of that. For all that, he could never be called a bad soldier. Some human faults are military virtues, like stupidity and arrogance and narrow-mindedness. Cardigan blended all three. With a passion for detail and accuracy, he was a perfectionist, and the manual of cavalry drill was his Bible. Whatever rested between the covers of that book, he could perform or cause to be performed with marvellous efficiency, and God help anyone who marred that performance. He would have made a first-class drill sergeant. Only a man with a mind capable of such depths of folly could have led six regiments into the valley at Balaclava. However, I devote some space to him because he played a not unimportant part in the career of Harry Flashman, and since it is my purpose to show how the Flashman of Tom Brown became the glorious Flashman with 4 inches in Who's Who and grew markedly worse in the process, I must say that he was a good friend to me. He never understood me, of course, which is not surprising. I took good care not to let him. When I met him in Canterbury, I had already given a good deal of thought to how I should conduct myself in the army. I was bent on as much fun and vicious amusement as I could get. My contemporaries, who praise God on Sundays and sneak off to child brothels during the week, would denounce it piously as vicious anyway. But I have always known how to behave to my superiors and shine in their eyes, a trait of mine which Hughes pointed out. Bless him. This I had determined on, and since the little I knew of Cardigan told me that he prized smartness and show above all things, I took some pains over my arrival at Canterbury. I rolled up to regimental headquarters in a coach, resplendent in my new uniform, and with my horses led behind and a wagon load of gear. Cardigan didn't see me arrive, unfortunately, but word must have been carried to him, for when I was introduced to him in his orderly room, he was in good humour.
"Aha, ha!" said he, as we shook hands. "It is Mr. Freshman. How do you do, sir? Welcome to the regiment. A good turnout, Jones," he went on to the officer at his elbow. "I delight to see a smart officer. Mr. Freshman, how tall are you?"
6 feet, sir," I said, which was near enough, right?
"Aha, ha! And how heavy do you ride, sir?"
I didn't know, but I guessed at 12.5 stone.
"Heavy for a light dragoon," said he, shaking his head. "But there are compensations. You have a proper figure, Mr. Freshman, and bear yourself well. Be attentive to your duties, and we shall deal very well together. Where have you hunted?"
"In Leicestershire, my lord," I said.
"Couldn't be better," says he. "Eh, Jones? Very good, Mr. Freshman. Hope to see more of you. Ha-ha-ha!"
Now, no one in my life that I could remember had ever been so damned civil to me, except toad-eaters like Speedycut, who didn't count. I found myself liking his lordship, and did not realize that I was seeing him at his best. In this mood he was a charming man enough, and looked well. He was taller than I, straight as a lance, and very slender, even to his hands. Although he was barely 40, he was already bald, with a bush of hair above either ear and magnificent whiskers. His nose was beaky, and his eyes blue and prominent and unwinking. They looked out on the world with that serenity which marks the nobleman whose uttermost ancestor was born a nobleman too. It is the look that your parvenu would give half his fortune for, that unruffleable gaze of the spoiled child of fortune, who knows with unshakable certainty that he is right and that the world is exactly ordered for his satisfaction and pleasure. It is the look that makes underlings writhe and causes revolution. I saw it then, and it remained changeless as long as I knew him, even through the roll call beneath Causeway Heights, when the grim silence as the names were shouted out testified to the loss of 500 of his command.
"It was no fault of mine," he said then, and he didn't just believe it, he knew it.
I was to see him in a different mood before the day was out, but fortunately I was not the object of his wrath. Quite the reverse, in fact. I was shown about the camp by the officer of the day, a fair young captain named Reynolds, with a brick-red face from service in India. Professionally he was a good soldier, but quiet and no blood at all. I was fairly off-hand with him, and no doubt insolent, but he took it without comment, confining himself to telling me what was what, finding me a servant, and ending at the stables where my mare, whom I had christened Judy, by the way, and Charger were being housed. The grooms had Judy trimmed up with her best leather work, and it was the best that the smartest saddler in London could show, and Reynolds was admiring her, when who should ride up but my lord, in the devil of a temper. He reined in beside us, and pointed with a hand that shook with fury to a troop that had just come in, under the sergeant, to the stable yard.
"Captain Reynolds," he bawled, and his face was scarlet, "is this your troop?"
Reynolds said it was.
"And do you see their sheepskins?" bawled Cardigan.
These were the saddle sheepskins.
"Do you see them, sir? What colour are they, I should like to know? Will you tell me, sir?"
"White, my lord."
"White, you say? Are you a fool, sir? Are you colour blind? They are not white, they are yellow, with inattention and slovenliness and neglect. They are filthy, I tell you."
Reynolds stood silent, and Cardigan raged on.
"This was no doubt very well in India, where you learned what you probably call your duty. I will not have it here, do you understand, sir?"
His eye rolled round the stable and rested on Judy.
"Whose horse is this?" he demanded.
I told him, and he turned in triumph on Reynolds.
"You see, sir, an officer new joined, and he can show you and your other precious fellows from India their duty. Mr. Freshman's sheepskin is white, sir, as yours should be, would be if you knew anything of discipline and good order, but you don't, sir, I tell you."
"Mr. Freshman's sheepskin is new, sir," said Reynolds, which was true enough. "They discolour with age."
"'So you make excuses now,' snapped Cardigan. "'Ha, ha! I tell you, sir, if you knew your duty, they would be cleaned, or if they are old, renewed. But you know nothing of this, of course. Your slovenly Indian ways are good enough, I suppose. Well, they will not do, let me tell you. Those skins will be queen tomorrow. Do you hear, sir? Queen, or I will hold you responsible, Captain Reynolds.'
And with that he rode off, head in the air, and I heard his "ha, ha, ha!" as he greeted someone outside the stable yard. I felt quite pleased to have been singled out for what was, in effect, praise, and I fancy I said something of this to Reynolds. He looked me up and down, as though seeing me for the first time, and said in that odd Welsh-sounding voice that comes with long service in India, "Yes, I can see you will do very well, Mr. Flashman. Lord Haw-Haw may not like us Indian officers, but he likes plungers, and I've no doubt you'll plunge her very prettily." I asked him what he meant by plunging. "Oh," says he, "a plunger is a fellow who makes a great turnout, don't you know, and leaves cards at the best houses, and is sought by mamas and strolls in the park very languid, and is just a hell of a swell generally. Sometimes they even condescend to soldier a little when it doesn't interfere with their social life. Good day, Mr. Flashman." I could see that Reynolds was jealous, and in my conceit I was well pleased. What he had said, though, was true enough. The regiment was fairly divided between Indian officers, those who had not left since returning home, and the plungers, to whom I naturally attached myself. They hailed me among them, even the noblest, and I knew how to make myself pleasant. I was not as quick with my tongue as I was to become later, but they knew me for a sporting fellow before I'd been there long, good on a horse, good with a bottle, for I took some care at first, and ready for mischief. I toadied as seemed best, not openly, of course, but effectively, just the same. There is a way of toadying which is better than fawning, and it consists of acting bluff and hearty, and knowing to an inch how far to go. And I had money, and showed it. The Indian officers had a bad time. Cardigan hated them. Reynolds and Forrest were his chief butts, and he was forever pestering them to leave the regiment and make way for gentlemen, as he put it. Why he was so down on those who had served in India, I was never entirely sure. Some said it was because they were not of the smart set or well-connected, and this was true up to a point. He was the damnedest snob. But I think his hatred of the Indian officers ran deeper. They were, after all, real soldiers with service experience, and Cardigan had never heard a shot outside the shooting range in his 20 years' service. Whatever the cause, he made their lives miserable, and there were several resignations in my first 6 months' service. Even for us plungers, it was bad enough, for he was a devil for discipline, and not all the plungers were competent officers. I saw how the wind set, and studied harder than I ever had at Rugby, mastering my drill, which wasn't difficult, and perfecting myself in the rules of camp life. I got an excellent servant named Bassett, a square-headed oaf who knew everything a soldier ought to know, and nothing more, and with a genius for boot polish. I thrashed him early in our acquaintance, and he seemed to think the better of me for it, and treated me as a dog does its master. Fortunately, I cut a good figure on parade and at exercise, which was where it counted with Cardigan. Probably only the regimental sergeant-major and one or two of the troop sergeants were my equals on horseback, and his lordship congratulated me once or twice on my riding. "Ha, ha," he would say. "Flashman sits well, I tell you. He will make an aide yet." I agreed with him. Flashman was sitting very well. In the mess, things went well enough. They were a fast crowd, and the money ran pretty free, for apart from parties and the high state which Cardigan demanded we should keep, there was some heavy gaming. All this expense discouraged the Indian men, which delighted Cardigan, who was forever sneering at them that if they could not keep up with gentlemen, they had better return to farming or set themselves up in trade, selling shoes and pots and pans, he would say, and laugh heartily, as though this were the funniest thing imaginable. Strangely enough, or perhaps not so strangely, his Indian prejudice did not extend to the men. They were a tough lot and excellent soldiers, as far as I could see. He was a tyrant to them, and never a week passed without a court-martial for neglect of duty or desertion or drunkenness. The last offence was common, but not seriously regarded, but for the other two he punished hard. There were frequent floggings at the rings in the side of the riding school, when we all had to attend. Some of the older officers, the Indian ones, grumbled a good deal and pretended to be shocked, but I guess they would not have missed it. Myself, I liked a good flogging, and used to have bets with Bryant, my particular crony, on whether the man would cry out before the 10th stroke, or when he would faint. It was better sport than most, anyway. Bryant was a queer little creature who attached himself to me early in my career and clung like a leech. He was your open toady, with little money of his own, but a gift of pleasing and being on hand. He was smart enough, and contrived to cut a decent figure, although never splendid, and he had all the gossip and knew everybody, and was something of a wit. He shone at the parties and mess nights which we gave for the local society in Canterbury, where he was very forward. He was first with all the news, and could recount it in a fashion that amused Cardigan, not that this was too difficult. I found him useful, and tolerated him accordingly, and used him as a court jester when it suited. He was adept in this role, too. As Forrest said, if you kicked Bryant's ass, he always bounced most obligingly. He had a considerable gift of spite against the Indian officers, which also endeared him to Cardigan. Oh, we were a happy little mess, I can tell you, and earned him their hatred. Most of them despised me, too, along with the other plungers, but we despised them for different reasons, so we were square there. But to only one officer did I take an active dislike, which was prophetic, and I guess that he returned it from the first. His name was Bernier, a tall, hard hawk of a man with a big nose and black whiskers and dark eyes set very close. He was the best blade and shot in the regiment, and until I came on the scene, the best rider as well. He didn't love me for that, I suppose, but our real hatred dated from the night when he made some reference to nabob families of no breeding, and seemed to look in my direction. I was fairly wine-flown, or I'd have kept my mouth shut, for he looked like what the Americans call a killing gentleman. Indeed, he was very like an American whom I knew later, the celebrated James Hickok, who was also a deadly shot. But, being part tipsy, I said I would rather be a nabob Briton and take my chance on breeding than be half-caste foreign. Bryant crowed, as he always did at my jokes, and said, "Bravo, Flash! Old England forever!" And there was general laughter, for my usual heartiness and general bluffness had earned me the name of being something of a John Bull. Bernier only half caught what I said, for I had kept my voice low so that only those nearest heard, but someone must have told him later on, for he never gave me anything but an icy stare from then on, and never spoke to me. He was sensitive about his foreign name. Actually, he was a French Jew, if you went back far enough, which accounts for it. But it was a few months after this incident that I really ran foul of Bernier, and began to make my reputation, the reputation which I still enjoy today. I pass over a good deal of what happened in that first year, Cardigan's quarrel with the Morning Post, for example, which had the regiment and the public generally in a fine uproar, but in which I had no part, and come to the famous Bernier-Flashman duel, which you will still hear talked about. I think of it only with pride and delight, even now. Only two men ever knew the truth of it, and I was one. It was a year almost to the day after I left Rugby that I was taking the air in Canterbury, in the park, and on my way to some mamma's house or other to make a call. I was in full fig and feeling generally pleased with myself when I spied an officer walking under the trees with a lady, arm in arm. It was Bernier, and I looked to see what heifer he was ploughing with. In fact, she was no heifer, but a wicked-looking little black-haired piece with a turned-up nose and a saucy smile. I studied her, and the great thought formed in my head. I'd had two or three mistresses in Canterbury, off and on, but nothing in particular. Most of the younger officers maintained a paramour in the town or in London, but I had never set up any establishment like that. I guessed that this was Bernier's mare of the moment, and the more I looked at her, the more she intrigued me. She looked the kind of plump little puss who would be very knowing in bed, and the fact that she was Bernier's, who fancied himself irresistible to women, would make the tumbling all the sweeter. I wasted no time, but found out her direction by inquiry, chose my time when Bernier was on duty, and called on the lady. She had a pleasant little retreat, very tastefully furnished, but in no great style. Bernier's purse was less fat than mine, which was an advantage. I pursued it. She was French herself, it turned out, so I could be more direct than with an English girl. I told her straight out that I had taken a fancy to her, and invited her to consider me as a friend, a close friend. I hinted that I had money. She was only a whore, after all, for all her fashionable airs. At first she made a show of being shocked and la-la'd a good deal, but when I made to leave she changed her tune. My money aside, I think she found me to her fancy. She toyed with a fan and looked at me over it with big almond-shaped eyes, playing the sly minx. "You have poor opinion of French girls, then," says she. "Not I," says I, charming again. "I've the highest opinion of you, for example. What's your name?"
"Josette,"
she said, it very pretty. "Well, Josette, let's drink to our future acquaintance, at my expense." And I dropped my purse on the table, at which her eyes widened. It was not a small purse. You may think me crude. I was. But I saved time and trouble, and perhaps money, too, the money that fools waste in paying court with presents before the fun begins. She had wine in the house, and we drank to each other and talked a good 5 minutes before I began to tease her into undressing. She played it very prettily with much pouting and provocative looks, but when she had stripped, she was all fire and wickedness, and I was so impatient I had her without getting out of my chair. Whether I found her unusually delectable because she was Bernier's mistress or because of her French tricks, I can't say, but I took to visiting her often, and in spite of my respect for Bernier, I was careless. It was within a week, certainly, that we were engaged heavily one evening, when there were footsteps on the stair, the door flew open, and there was the man himself. He stood glaring for a moment, while Josette squeaked and dived beneath the covers, and I scrambled to get under the bed in my shirt tail. The sight of him filled me with panic. But he said nothing. A moment passed, the door slammed, and I came out scrabbling for my breeches. At that moment I wanted only to put as much distance between myself and him as I could, and I dressed in some haste. Josette began to laugh, and I asked her what the devil amused her.
"It is so funny," she giggled. You half beneath the bed, and Charles glaring so fierce at your derriere?"
And she shrieked with laughter. I told her to hold her tongue, and she stopped laughing and tried to coax me back to bed again, saying that Bernier had undoubtedly gone, and sitting up and shaking her tits at me. I hesitated between lust and fright until she hopped out and bolted the door, and then I decided I might as well have my sport while I could, and pulled off my clothes again. But I confess it was not the most joyous pleasuring I've taken part in, although Josette was at her most spirited. I suspect she was thrilled by the situation. I was in two minds whether to go back to the mess afterwards, for I was sure Bernier must call me out. But, to my surprise, when I pulled my courage together and went in to dinner, he paid me not the slightest notice. I couldn't make it out, and when next day and the next he was still silent, I took heart again and even paid Josette another visit. She had not seen him, so it seemed to me that he intended to do nothing at all. I decided that he was a poor-spirited thing, after all, and had resigned his mistress to me. Not, I was sure, out of fear of me, but because he could not bear to have a trollop who cheated him. Of course, the truth was that he couldn't call me out without exposing the cause and making himself look ridiculous. And knowing more of regimental custom than I did, he hesitated to provoke an affair of honour over a mistress. But he was holding himself in with difficulty. Not knowing this, I took to throwing my chest out again and let Bryant into the secret. The toady was delighted, and soon all the plungers knew. It was then only a matter of time before the explosion came. As I should have known it would. End of side 2.